Hold on to your butts, it's time for a new episode of Destroy All Culture, a sonic death ray from Dimension X that sounds exactly like a weekly podcast hosted by Adam P. Nave and Aiden Morgan. Exposure to Destroy All Culture is 100% fatal, so we put it on the internet. Now listen and die! Lethal effects may take up to 75 years. And welcome to Destroy All Culture, episode 170. I am Adam P. Nave, and with me as always is Aiden Morgan.
Whip-bip-a-dip-blip.
Well,
the proper answer was a whip blip blip, but that's all right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, actually, the strange bird noise thing. I don't know if you watch. There's a YouTube show called Hot Ones.
Yes. Where celebrities eat spicy food. Yeah.
Right, and weirdly, like the guy who Sean, I think his first name is the guy who does the interviews. Actually, they do a lot of really interesting research. Like, they always have, questions that dig, way back into things. You're like, really?
Yeah.
That you never see anywhere else,
yeah.
Right? And they had the start of the new season dropped, and it had Margot Robbie.
Oh.
And partway through, he kind of brings in, and, you know, a bunch of the other people from Birds of Prey. And for some reason, when he does, he makes this kind of, trilling bird noise out of nowhere, both times. And, everyone else just looks at him like, what are you doing? And just, cracks up. As if it was a battle cry. I don't know why he did it, but it was perfect.
That sounds. If the subject is Birds of Prey, I think weird, out of nowhere, cartoonish choices are probably the right
yes.
way to go.
So we've both seen the movie.
Yes.
What did you think?
I had a fine time at Birds of Prey. I thought there were some. I thought there were some great moments in it. I like the. I much prefer the. I mean, as I knew I would. I prefer Harley Quinn without sort of the Joker. Although of course, specter of the Joker looms large in many ways. And I also like that when I saw the trailer, there were all these sort of dramatic slow motion reaction shots from Robbie's
right.
Quinn, and it turns out that that entire thing was about a sandwich.
Yes.
this is. I thought this. Is very relatable content.
It is, isn't it? It's funny because I've also caught up on the animated show.
Oh yeah, me too. Yeah.
And while I deeply enjoyed the movie, I do wonder, with the animated show, if it would be more popular, make more money if we made it PG-13. If we just cut back a little bit on the blood, if we cut back a little bit on the cursing, or even a lot on the cursing, we don't really need it. And it's not that I'm against these things, because I'm not.
Right.
I think they really do work in the movie. But there is a version that is more, I don't know, wide watchable?
Sure. Yeah,
and I don't know that it's
know
necessary, but it's just interesting to me.
Yeah, I think you're right. It would have been, I would have enjoyed it just as much with less of that. Oh, that cursing is so unnecessary. No, it would have been fine, and the violence quotient. Although I have to admit, that was some pretty spectacular violence.
Oh yeah, that was John Wick level.
Yeah, that whole scene in I'm not even sure what the location was, but it was in a warehouse or something where she's just
the evidence room.
Yes, that's it. Thank you. Yeah,
the metal bat stuff was incredible.
Jesus Christ! I was like
the bounce.
Yeah, and I was like, this is almost. It's not quite Hong Kong action film, but it was certainly getting into that territory with just
yeah.
the sort of the acrobatics and the way that physics was fuck it, this is just going to do what we want.
Well, I mean, to be fair though, it wasn't the physics
no.
of that, with that bat, were all dead on.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. I'm being hyperbolic.
But but later on, that's the thing. It's the later action scenes started to bend things a little bit.
Yeah, but that was the point in which I was watching, and I'm like, oh, I get what's going on. She's Bugs Bunny. That's
yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
And I will say, as far as the cursing goes. As much as, I'm the one who brought it up, maybe this would be a just as good a movie without the cursing. There is something to be said, always, for certain people cursing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? They just... they just bring a little something, like Rosie Perez cursing.
Yeah.
Is it's like Marissa Tomei, right? Like some both of them just have this cadence when they curse that you're just like, I don't even know that they're cursing. You know, it's just breathing for them.
Exactly. Or for example, I think I'm not sure I would enjoy Doom Patrol half as much if not for Brendan Fraser's sort of trademark the fuck. I just can't imagine it. It just you could tell if they shied away from it there, it would feel like they wanted to say it and you'd notice it, if that makes sense.
Right. I mean, and I feel the same way about Deadpool, that for the most part it would work either way. Mm-hmm. And again, like, I do really enjoy the movie we got, don't get me wrong.
Right.
What's funny is that, like, I've seen a bunch of people already who are just like, oh, well, Black Mask, he was just, you know, because they didn't want to use the Joker. He was basically the Joker. And I'm like, well, sort of, the point is that, like, Gotham is full of just men like this.
They even outright say so.
Yeah.
At the end, they're like, well,
that was
he's
the point.
Gone.
What are you watching?
I know. He's gone, but Gotham is still full of assholes, basically. I know that they didn't go fully into, like, the history of Black Mask and why he had the mask.
Didn't have to.
In the movie, yeah, exactly. They didn't have to. And I really, really enjoyed McGregor's portrayal of Roman Sionis. I was just like, those moments when he's like showing her like his room full of trophies. It's like, look at that. So tight. Ew, gross.
What was really funny for me.
What's that?
Was I was like, oh God, he's gone back to like channeling bits of, God, I always forget the name of this fucking movie too. The Danny Boyle thing he did.
Oh yeah.
With, Eccleston.
Yeah, yeah. Is it Shallow Grave we're talking about?
Shallow Grave, yeah. Which is one of my favorite movies.
Oh, I love that.
But it felt very much like he was tapping back into that.
Yes. Yeah, and I hadn't really seen McGregor doing anything like this in a long time.
Right.
The other thing that I thought was really funny, it was occurred to me while I was watching the movie, and I looked at Quinn and all the various, you know, the Birds of Prey. It was like each one seemed to come from a different movie. Sometimes they kind of lampshade it with Perez's character when they say you talk like an 80s action cop.
Right.
But if you look at Huntress, Cathy Ann just basically riffed on a Tarantino revenge flick. Essentially,
yeah,
she just pulled
but
that.
I mean, that is the character, too.
Yeah.
So,
And Black Canary was pulled from like a sort of a 70s blaxploitation movie. Like there's only a certain extent to which they do it. Could have leaned into this harder, but I enjoyed the way they were just sort of mashing up different genres with each character.
Exactly.
That was great.
Also, I'm almost a little mad at Chris Messina, because if you read the comics at all, Victor Zsasz is not a character anyone has ever given a shit about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in the comics, he's this serial killer in Gotham who gives himself, like, a scar every time he kills someone.
Right.
And, like, the whole thing is, like, his body is covered in scars, seeing what a killer he is. And that's it. That's the entire character. Right? Like, you have, like, you know, Batman villains that are like, I'm the Penguin because I like penguins, you know, or I like riddles. And this guy's just like, I cut myself when I kill people. Like, he's just useless, right?
Yeah.
But that's in this movie is fucking hysterical.
I got to admit, I got a huge kick out of Zsasz. And I didn't even realize it was Chris Messina for a while until I just looked at him and went, oh, shit, that's Chris Messina. What? Yeah.
Yeah. It was the movie it needed to be.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, in ways that, actually, when I was coming home because I went to go see it with friends, one of the things that was said on the way home was, I haven't laughed this hard at a DC movie in years. And I pointed out, I haven't laughed this hard at a DC movie that meant me to be laughing at this hard in years.
Yes.
Little harsh? Sure. But true.
Exactly. No, I mean, I just enjoyed the hell out of this film. And oddly enough, it was the first time I watched like one of these DC films and thought, I bet that would play even better on a second watch.
Well, that's the other thing, right? Like, I kind of really do want to see it again.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that I'll get to it in the theater just because who has time these days?
Right.
But if I had time, you know, I would definitely go do the thing, frankly.
Right. Well, it's that first sort of first third to first half of the film, which keeps on chopping up the narrative,
Right.
and it's like that works really well from the point of view of Harley Quinn narrating it, because it's just it's the way her brain works, right? Just
Right.
puts pieces here and there, and it's like, oh wait, I forgot this bit. Like, that was a lot of fun, but I think I'd love to go back and see how the pieces fit together, because I think there's lots of little sort of bits and bobs that you miss first time around.
Yeah. I also do like that they never forgot that she was a full-on like psychologist. She had her PhD. She kept just analyzing characters randomly.
That was great. Yeah. Traditionally, violence rarely brings catharsis that one is looking for. Yeah, and yes, I thought that made that I thought was really kind of, I don't know, important to show that,
Yeah.
like, she wasn't just like chaos. She actually, there was a mind in there that could sometimes come together, and that there was somebody who was, you know, not just saying, oh, I have a PhD, but actually displaying the knowledge. Oh, that was great.
Right. Like I do feel that DC missed a weird opportunity to have an ad for their streaming service for that Harley Quinn show though, because it is very much of a thing. You know, like that's very much this version of Harley Quinn amped up even further, frankly. And it's delight it continues to be delightful, the last episode. Delightful.
I gotta say, yes. I don't know how many episodes they've
I think it's 13.
it's 13. Okay, so
I
we're
think there's like
just
two left.
yeah. I wasn't quite sure, but I figured as much. The one funny thing about the Harley Quinn cartoon, or the one thing I'm intrigued by, was their decision not to lean into the Bensonhurst accent, even while they still gave her like a Bensonhurst Jewish family. They still
Right.
kept it. They
A
can't
little bit apart, just
a
so that,
little
yeah,
bit.
it didn't feel overwhelming.
Yeah, I think so. I think they wanted something that wasn't. I think they wanted to tone down on that sort of. On sort of the broadness of that. So they're, yeah. But
Yeah.
I wouldn't have complained, even if they still had
No,
it.
it's true.
In the, yeah.
So yeah, Birds of Prey. Woo.
Now, did you say
Ah.
till the very end?
Yes.
Okay. Because
Yes.
there was the
And we won't
major.
spoil that.
Right.
There is a thing.
There is a thing.
I don't think it counts as a end credit scene, but there's a thing
There's a
worth waiting
thing.
for.
And it is probably the one sort of solid link between the new Harley Quinn cartoon and
Yeah.
the rest of Harley Quinn. Yeah.
You know, it gives me that feeling of like, and again, not that they should, but you know, because I do know the cartoon and all the time watches, I'm like, man, I want this version of Clayface to show up. Like, just not that I actually like need a live action version of that cartoon, but just those characters fit so well in this Gotham.
Yes. I kind of love that. Although it's funny, because I feel like if I were watching the Birds of Prey film, and something like Clayface, like legitimate superpowers, like
Right.
character showed up, I think it would interrupt the tone of at least this film. But I could picture like
Fair.
a Harley Quinn or Birds of Prey sequel that begins to lean heavier into the
Right.
cartoonish elements. Yeah. I have to say, I love Clayface, like getting motion sickness, throwing up, and then just kind of absorbing himself.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you live with yourself? That was.
Also, just one of the best comedy slow walks in a while.
Oh shit! Yeah, they really they when you expect it, I thought, okay, that's gonna be one shot, two, three shots. Oh, they're just gonna make a whole scene out of this slow motion
Like,
walk, aren't they?
that felt like they'd talked to someone who works on, like, early Archer.
Yeah.
For just, like, how do you, like, just master comedic timing in a cartoon?
Yes.
Because it's always trickier, right? For
Right.
whatever reason. But anyway,
Anyway.
so I also did want to talk a little bit. I know that we talked briefly, like you've only seen two episodes. I've seen the most recent, but about Picard.
Picard. Star Trek Picard.
Yes.
Picard.
The rarest card in Uno.
But the most delicious. Anyway.
Just because I've seen a thing going around, and it's fascinating, because I don't think it's wrong. It's just, it's a fascinating realization that I hadn't really linked in my head, was that Picard is basically Star Trek's Last Jedi.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know, that like both Picard and Luke were kind of failed by the institutions they had given themselves to.
Mm-hmm.
In completely different ways, but still.
Right, right.
And they both kind of went into exile for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it is fascinating to see the differences in how both characters come out of that.
Yes. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Picard just has to get himself a ship. I know he does in the third episode. But... Well, that's fascinating. You know what? Actually, you know what it reminds me of? Actually, I had a similar thought, but it wasn't Last Jedi. It was Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Because sort of Smiley is pretty much the same character. He's like a former spy at the beginning of Tinker Tailor, who is now retired and has been frozen out by an institution that, as it turns out, has been corrupted by Moscow, and his work is to very carefully and slowly, but rivetingly, sort of rescue that institution and restore it to its former status. Similar deal.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting story. I think fandom-wise, just having both Star Trek and Star Wars kind of grapple with this,
right,
is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The
only thing I worried about was in the second episode, when you discover that that one character is a Romulan spy, but she's changed her appearance to look human. She's played by Peyton List, who is kind of like the. In some ways, like the modern Ed McGimley, or McGinley, I can't remember his name now. But every time she shows up in a series that I really like, it's like, oh, this is going to last one season and then get canceled.
So, I believe Picard's already been renewed for a second.
So. All right, then. We're
don't
good.
Quote me on that. But.
I think you're right, actually. So not even the Peyton List curse can kill this one.
I mean, yet.
Not yet. That's right. Maybe the climate change.
Yeah, it has been
change...
renewed for a second season.
Okay, well, maybe the climate change apocalypse will cancel all television.
Sure.
I can blame...
Anything's possible.
I can blame Peyton List for it. Get a Reddit thread started. But yes, so far, I mean, I'm enjoying Picard, but I do find I did watch the first two episodes and I thought. This kind of feels like half an episode worth of story.
Yeah, the third episode kind of fixes it for me.
Oh, thank God.
It does a little bit of that. It's still moving very slowly, but it starts to add characters where you have actual forward momentum.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, no, I think like the third episode's where the show kind of is starting to really become the show.
Phew. Because you know, and it's sort of, yeah. I don't mind the slow movement too much, but it I thought in the pilot, I'm like, I'm cool with the pace. And then the second episode was like that, and I'm like, well, yeah, you know, I want to start moving this along, guys.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, what episode does he like end up on the Orville? You know, like, I don't know when this is happening.
Right.
Oh, terrible thing.
Yeah. Although I do like that the Orville feels more like the Next Generation than Star Trek Picard.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Or Discovery. Like, that's the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But what else was there? Oh, there was a Magicians episode.
Oh, yes. It was magical. Just saying
which
that.
Is funny, if only because, you know, given their log lines, like, you can't really... guess anything?
No. Although, the logline for the fifth one kind of tipped its hand.
Let's see, the fifth... Yeah, next week... Well, actually, I don't know. Next week is Katie punches a dude, Margot misses cocaine. And six, because five and six will both air the same week, is
right.
Margot and Elliot have a bad day. And I think that's, you know, with the title of Oops, I Did It Again, and we know there's a time loop episode coming, it's like, okay.
Right.
That's obviously where that is. But what killed me was I felt like episode four, Julia lends a book to some lady, Fogg finds a sock. I feel like the first part of that should have been obvious to us.
Right.
And it wasn't, at least to me.
Okay. I mean, it didn't seem obvious, but I was but when she, gets the book out, and it's, of course, oh my God, what's the actor's name? The Max Headroom guy. Why is it so out of my head?
God, I'm blanking on it too.
That's crazy. I've known his name for years. All right, whatever.
Yeah.
I just
Anyway.
forget, as soon as we start a podcast, I forget everybody's names.
Matt Frewer.
Matt Frewer. God damn
I
it.
Actually had to go by way of Eureka. That's kind of sad. But anyway.
And I have to say I missed his omniscient narration shtick. That was yeah. I mean, a little bit goes a long way, so that was good.
And again, like the whole they're airing 5 and 6 together, and I just bring this up because apparently part of the reason was that the cliffhanger in episode 5 is so huge. They were just
Wow.
like, holy shit, and that 6 was such a like a thing that they were like, you know what, just do both at once. And I
Well.
say that given the cliffhanger in episode 4, I'm just like, I don't want to know what the cliffhanger in 5 is at that point. If 4 isn't the big one,
Yeah, I know.
we just have to move that and point at the moon.
I love that. I love that sort of their task. It's like, oh, I just gotta move the moon. That's, no big.
And I do love the capper on that too. At least we know where it is.
Yes, that was kind of delightful. Yeah, no, this, I mean, Season 5 of The Magicians is shaping up to be, I think, a lot stronger than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
I mean,
You know,
I
Margot as a
figured,
warrior is a new thing.
yeah, I like that. Katie getting consistently good stories. Oh, and of course, Penny 23 losing his abilities. That's another
Well, and
interesting
kind
twist.
of.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah. But again, this Penny can still do magic. So.
Right. You just can't zip around and
But they.
can't
Right.
keep
Well,
the
they remove
slots.
the magic door, which is probably a good thing.
Yes, and actually, I want to talk about that in relation
Yeah?
to lock and key when we get into
Oh, yeah.
that.
Well, talk about Lock and Key, because.
Oh, sure. So,
Let's just jump right in.
all
Because
right.
I haven't seen Lock and Key, and. What I was going to tell you before, it was like I've had a lot of friends who've recommended the comic over the years, and I've oddly never read it.
I think I'm one of them. I think I've probably recommended it to you.
Yeah, I actually had a friend give me. I actually have the first volume,
Oh.
and I've just never gotten around to it. Partially because I knew that like if I started it, I'd want to read the rest, and I'm so far behind on everything. I'm like, I'll get there eventually.
No, I'm a huge fan of Lock and Key. I remember when I first read it, I thought this would make a killer movie or a television show. But it's weird how. Are you familiar with some of the production, the troubled and strange history of Lock and Key?
Not really, no. I mean, I know that there
Oh.
has been, but I don't know anything about it.
This Netflix's Lock and Key is, I believe, the third attempt to bring it
Really?
to television.
Huh.
So they so back so of course the graphic novel came out in the late aughts, I guess, it
Yeah.
was, and I think it was Fox. Fox decided to make a pilot. They were gonna they're I think they were sending it to series. They even aired the pilot, or didn't air it, but they screened it at two Comic Con in 2011. And they it sort of had, like, at what at the time was sort of a lineup of sort of TV genre TV superstars. Like, they had Kurtzman and Orci were developing it. Josh Friedman, who had done Terminator: The Sarah Connor Chronicles, was the showrunner, and the pilot was directed by Mark Romanek, who sort of
Okay.
at the time, I mean, he's still, big deal, but at the time he had done lots of stuff. He had recently done Never Let Me Go, the Kazuo
Right.
Ishiguro adaptation. And so they, but Fox sort of screened it. I think the reaction was sort of mixed. There is a trailer you can find on YouTube. And I think people just kind of didn't quite know what to make of it because it's weird because Lock and Key sounds like a really simple premise, but when you actually break it down, it's much more complicated than it seems. But at any rate, because so to stick with the comic is, I think, presents some problems. So anyway, so after Fox passed, the rights reverted, and then Hulu picked it up. And they were filming a pilot. They had several scripts already completed. And then, for reasons I don't think anybody really knows, they're like, nope, we won't do this. And that was in 2015.
Okay.
And then Netflix picked it up. And this time, but Netflix didn't take any of the scripts from the pilot like that they'd completed. They scrapped everything and just did it again from scratch. And what we get is finally, for them, Lock and Key fans. Lock and Key.
All right.
And
Does it live
which.
up to all of the time and
Well, it. I'll put it this way. If you look at the reviews, reviews again are mixed. But I'll tell you, I don't generally binge shows much anymore. Like, especially
Right.
Netflix shows, I find I'll get about 20 minutes in and I'll think, well, I think I've seen this. But Lock and Key kept me going. So I watched all 10 episodes from Friday
Nice.
to this morning. So obviously, I must have enjoyed it. The first half of the season is a little rough, and it's mostly because it's on Netflix, and to a certain extent, everything on Netflix seems like determined by this iron cold algorithm. A lot of it leans pretty heavily into teen high school drama, which is only moderately interesting, frankly. Like the sort of the YA elements are just kind of like, well, whatever. But the horror elements, they do, I think, a really they do a really decent job with the horror. They keep it a little lighter
Okay.
than the comic. Like the horror elements of the comic are really gruesome in just the sort of Lovecraftian fashion. And the horror elements of this are they're sort of they give you a little bit of a jolt, but they're a lot more sort of palatable, I guess you could say. And it's funny because the town in which the everything takes place in the comics is called Lovecraft. But the town
Subtle.
yeah, I know. But the town in which the Massachusetts town in which everything takes place in the series is called Matheson. And I'm just convinced I'm pretty sure they're naming it after Richard Matheson. Sort of like, a more like a modern sort of pulpy sort of like mid-century science fiction horror writer as opposed to cosmic horror. And I think the change is I think it's kind of a wink to sort of more of what they're going for. So yeah, that's kind of it. I think the premise, I mean, I love the premise of Lock and Key. For those who haven't read the comic or don't know anything about the show, it's a family moving from in the show Seattle to the ancestral mansion called Key House. They're moving because their father, Randall Locke, was murdered in Seattle. And as it turns out, there's a dark secret underpinning his murder, and it has to do with the house in which contains a number of keys, and these keys are magic. There's the anywhere key, which lets you go through a door to any other door anywhere, as long as you know the door in question. There's the head key, which allows you to go into your own or somebody else's head. And they've got an interesting way of doing this on the show because in the comic you literally jump into somebody's head, and it's probably impossible to film except on a very huge budget. So they have a good I think they have a really good workaround for this. Basically, a
Okay.
door just kind of pops open or just shows up, and you kind of go like it out of nowhere, and you just go through it. And there's other keys. There's this flame key, which makes things, burn, obviously. And so on. There's, like, the ghost key, which you go through the right door and you become, like, this sort of ghost that can fly around while your body looks dead. anywho. So, one of the problems, and it's actually the same problem that you get with Penny 23 being able to just jump anywhere, comes with something like the anywhere key. Because right. Very early on in the series, and I'm going to spoil a few things for the series here, the main villain, who is a girl that lives at the bottom of a well for reasons to get into, is stuck there, but she manages to sort of manipulate the young boy, Bodhi, into giving her the anywhere key, which allows her to get out of the well and then go anywhere. And there's this entire sequence where she's just, like, jumping all over the world and just enjoying herself. Like
you would, yeah.
Yeah, like ripping shit off or seeing cool shit. But obviously the problem is once you give your villain that much power, and because she knows, like, Keyhouse, she can just show up there anytime and from any door, then you've essentially a whole bunch of the story immediately has to launch into reasons why she can't do
right.
that. Or there's two things. One, you either have to, like, provide a bunch of reasons and spend time telling why she can't, or you just ignore it and
yeah.
say, well, just fuck it. They don't do it because they don't do it. And the series kind of tries to do both at once. And
huh.
I'm not sure. Either you're going to be into it and you're not going to give a shit, or you're going to notice it and you're just going to be like, well, come on, guys. So that's one of the problems, and I don't really care about this too much because I just enjoy the series. But one of the issues is that after a while, the villain gets all these keys and gets so overpowered that you're just wondering, why don't they just show up and do things?
Right.
And one of the ways they get around it is by the fact that she can't take the keys from the locks once they have them. They have to give them willingly. But there are so many sort of pain points with the lock family because they're kids. There are so many ways you can basically, like, manipulate them or, like,
right.
visit misery, because there's the mother, right, who, because she's an adult, cannot understand the magic or remember it. So even when she's, like, brought face to face with it, she, like, a moment later, she's like, oh, wasn't that funny? And then she just forgets.
Gotcha.
Except when she drinks, and then she remembers, which is really funny. Quiet there, kitty. Sorry, I got one of my cats.
You're fine.
Yeah, yelping at me. So that's one of the things. Like, it's a bit like having, like, giving a character plot vision and then sort of going, well, I guess it's not just not going to be used for this point because for reasons. And of course, also the discovery of the keys is just—it's tremendously convenient. Like,
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure it would have to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like if in Star Trek Into Darkness, like, Abrams' strategy for ending every scene was to have a conversation happen, and then when the characters ran out of things to say, there'd be an explosion.
Yeah.
No,
like
I'm
Aquaman.
Not, yeah. What's that?
Like Aquaman.
Like Aquaman. There we go. However, in Lock and Key, it's not that cut and dried, but there is an element of, like, well, we need something to happen now for the show to keep going, so let's have one of them find a key. And these are not really criticisms. It's just kind of the nature of this particular beast.
Sure.
But it does show kind of the limitations of sort of the genre TV setup in some cases, when the comic doesn't really have the same kinds of problems, because it can often just rely on, like, much more dense and, like, unorthodox plotting that a TV series can't really, without running into severe problems with pacing and watchability.
Gotcha. And not to jump back and forth, but it's one of the things I actually did like about how Magicians has dealt with Penny for a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Just in that it has at least always felt like they have good baked in reasons. Like, it's not dodges for why he can't just always go everywhere that they need him to.
Right. Yeah, it's more like, yeah, I mean, there are reasons baked into his character why he just doesn't flit around all the time.
Right.
And I suppose if you went in and were able to rewrite Magicians, you could say, well, let's just have him do this, that, and the next thing. But it just, yeah, I don't know. That would be a much less satisfying program.
Yeah, no, and I think, again, like they handled it for the most part well. And I do kind of wonder if part of the removing it is where they're going, it would actually get in their way.
Yeah, that's possible.
And that's, I mean, again, like, I have no problem with this, right? Like,
right.
If only because it works so well. Like, overall, all of this works so well that why would you mess with it?
Yeah, exactly. I have to say, I'm very glad you got on the with Magicians, because I was watching it, and I'm like, I think, you know, Adam would enjoy this quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I really did get into it after a while. Yeah. And I don't know.
Who even knows? Who knows what's happening?
Who even knows? Oh man. So yeah. I am looking forward to two episodes of Magicians at once. I also am kind of not. If that makes sense.
No, that makes no sense at all. You better explain yourself, sir.
It just, there are times when that the show is just hard enough. You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I get you.
That I'm just like, I don't know if I want to, you know, I'll binge it, but I always binge it after I've seen it now.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it for me is like, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I could, binging The Magicians, like, if I had never seen The Magicians and I just binged it, especially when we start getting into season 3, I think that would just be, I would need breaks. I'll put it
right.
That way.
And that's, yeah. And that's the thing. So, yeah. Like, because they don't give you breaks.
No.
It becomes one of these, like, well now what? Oh.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. Again, I love the show, don't get me wrong.
But oh, yes.
There is that thing where I'm like, it kind of hurts sometimes.
It's
in a good way, but it kind of hurts sometimes.
Exactly. Just this sort of Narnia Potter mashup for grown-ups.
That has become Gamble. So much more.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's funny because it was pretty easy to, like, joke about it as, like, edgy, like, you know, edgelord Harry Potter in the first season.
Sure.
But, or, you know, edgelord Narnia Potter in the first season. But I have to say, one of the most pleasing developments was how quickly, after the first season, they got away from that. Because that was not a sustainable thing. I'll just put it that way.
No.
No.
And, you know, the further they got from the books, the better off we all were.
Yes.
And again, like, I've never actually read the books, but what's fascinating, actually, speaking of, Brittany Curran did an interview recently where she mentioned something about the books that, like, I had never even thought of and was like, oh, wow, I really don't ever want to read these books.
Oh.
She mentioned that she was, you know, when she first got the job for Fenn, that, like, Fenn apparently, like, comes on and then dies within 20 pages.
Yeah, I think so. I don't really remember much about it. I mean, I read I read the books a while back, and then I was just like, oh, there's a character that whose development is, I guess rape is a, a character beat for this character. Okay.
Right. I
No
mean, and
thanks.
that, it's
Yeah.
like I know a lot of the
It's
characters are
still there.
very, very different, like Margot and Elliot especially. But like, just the idea, like Fenn doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just doesn't make me ever want to pick up those books. Like all the stuff I love about this show isn't in the books.
Oh God, I was watching like a weird sort of not a blooper reel, but just this jokey video that Brittany Curran had made with the other cast members as
Yeah.
Fenn, and it's just kind of you realize that Brittany Curran is just kind of filthy, and it's really endearing.
Oh yeah, well I mean I don't know if you saw like online there's like Fenstagram videos they did before the season.
Yes. I think
Which
that
are all
was.
just priceless.
I think that's what I'm talking about, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a feeling it might be. Yeah, and you know, she's working on her and oh what's her name, who plays Katie are both working on, and mostly it's Brittany Curran, are working on a whiskey documentary.
Really?
Yeah, because Curran is heavily into whiskeys.
That's what I'm absolutely unsurprised.
Right?
If you had to tell me anything about Brittany Curran and you told me that, I'd be like, after seeing those videos, I'm like, oh, yep, that tracks.
Yeah. So, anywho,
Anywho, indeed.
doo
Now.
ba-doo-ba-doo-ba-ka.
Pecaw.
Oh, I don't know.
So you mentioned before we started that there was a book you were going to be on the
Oh,
reread path.
yeah, I think it's about time for me to reread The Writer's Tale again.
Oh, I've never read it.
Really?
Yeah.
I've been hyping this book to you for years, sir.
I
Get
know,
on
I
with it.
know, I know.
Get on with it. Yeah, no, it just came up in conversation like twice in the last couple weeks. For people who don't know, which I can't include Frank at this point, I'm sure. The Writer's Tale is a series of emails between Russell Davies and a journalist whose name I forget, who worked for like Doctor Who magazine and all this, and who mailed Davies and was like, you know, how about we do an article where you just email me stuff while you're writing your series four of Doctor Who. Right, with Tennant and Donna as the companion. But at that point, like season four didn't exist. We didn't actually have Donna as the companion yet. And Davy says, sure. And A, it quickly became like a book. Because they're mailing each other constantly. B, I think the volume you'd get now, if you can find it, I don't know if you can find it in the US at all, but I think Canada you probably can, is called The Final Journey, I think. And it actually has a
Okay.
second book in it.
Oh.
Because after the book came out, they kept emailing. And so there's a bunch of emails about the tours that they did for the book, but also about Davies doing the Tennant specials and the end of his
Ah.
run. Including, like, handing it off to Moffat.
Huh.
And the thing about this, and he was also doing Torchwood at the time. And some Sarah Jane stuff. The thing about it isn't that it is this masterclass in how to write anything. Because it isn't. You'll get to see, like, development of stuff. If you like those series of Doctor Who, you'll get to see a lot of the development in details that you never even considered.
Right.
Like the companion that almost was.
Interesting.
And how she actually shows up once. Like, little weird things like this. And little production stories, obviously, right? But it is the single most honest book about how writing feels that I've ever seen in my life.
I've read Davies writing about the productions. I mean, I've a feeling I've probably read excerpts of this book.
Right.
And yeah, though it is really the way he writes about the process of writing,
Yeah, just like sending these
and
emails at 3 in the morning where he's like, I just want to go out to the club and get drunk and like fuck some guy, but like A, I'm
yeah.
engaged. B, like I'm not 20 anymore.
Right.
You know, and C, I have a deadline and I just can't write. like, it just, and this constant, like, I can't write, I can't write, I can't write, and then suddenly the dam breaks and he writes everything in a day and a half.
Oh, yes. Boy, do I.
You know, there's a big struggle where he was going to write a bunch of Torchwood and then had to back out of it.
Huh.
And just being honest about the struggle, like, he felt like he was letting the entire production team there down. But, like, his producers were like, no, we've been waiting for you to admit this. Like, we have a plan. Like, we know you're bad about admitting this sort of thing, so we just, we were working with you. Don't worry.
Wow. Oh, cool.
And it's all of this stuff. It is just unflinchingly honest and fascinating. Like, from the Doctor Who angle alone, it's fascinating. But just from the, this is what a writer's brain looks like, it's fascinating.
Nice.
Because I've never seen something so relatable. Like, and again, like, you know, we both write. And I think anyone who does write, like, there is that thing where you're like, these are these struggles, and I know that they're not just me, because they can't be, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The world is too large.
Right.
But at the same hand, we, like, even when we start to talk about them and a bunch of other people chime in with, like, oh yeah, that happens to me too, you don't quite buy it, because you're like, yeah, but it's still different in my head. Like, not worse or anything, but just, like, and again, like, not in a bad way, but just there is that feeling, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I,
and having
exactly.
someone just lay their soul bare about it. Is just a revelation.
Yeah, and you
because
feel...
his position isn't relatable in terms of, like, you know, the biggest writer in the UK at the time. But
the struggle is, yeah.
The struggle is, yeah.
Oh, I love that. Okay, I'm gonna.
At one point, the reporter goes when they're doing some of the specials. They did the one in the desert.
With
the bus and all this.
Yeah,
and you know, like that bus. Like, that ends up in the special, like, it's all wrecked and it wasn't supposed to be.
Oh, shit.
Like, the bus got fucked in shipping, and, like, he had to do rewrites.
Oh.
Like, within a day. But the journalist got invited to cover the filming. Davies didn't go because he was still on deadline. So there's this weird kind of, like, Davies being a little bit petulant about, like, I'm not there, hope you're having fun. Like, you know, say hi to these people for me. There's just that little note of, like, fuck you.
Nice.
But it's also interesting just to see these people become friends over the course of this, right? Because they didn't really know each other well when it started. It was just a lark of an idea. But then they write this book, and the book becomes really popular, and it's a bestseller, and then they're going on book tours, so they kept emailing. And now it's do another one type of thing.
Right.
And the other one never saw print by itself. They just decide to, you know, launch an expanded edition.
Cool. You know, and I should say my friend Spencer actually has a copy of this, I believe, so I should I should just borrow it from him.
Yeah, it also has a bunch of script excerpts.
It's a sizable
and Davies,
book,
who
if I recall.
Is an artist. Oh yeah. But it's a very quick read.
Oh yeah.
And again, a lot of it is, there's a lot of script excerpts in there. Also Davies is an artist, so there's a lot of his sketches of things.
Oh, okay.
Which are fascinating too, just because they're all really good. You know, just some things that are just confirmed that, like, we all knew that, like, you know, like, I should find a way to bring the Jadoon back just because I love writing dialogue for them because it's so ridiculous. And, like, you feel like that's the only reason the Jadoon had ever come back for any writer.
Oh, God, yes.
Is it's just fun to write, like, co, blow, flow, co. You know, it's fun.
Yes.
But having that kind of admitted, just, like, okay, yeah, we all knew.
Oh, that is kind of delightful. I'm just sort of picturing, like, a version of the book, like, but with Moffat instead of Davies.
That would not be as much fun.
No. I'm clever.
There is a section or two that Moffat writes. Like, there's an email or two that is from Moffat, with permission, obviously, when Moffat was taking over.
Oh, yes.
But again, and also, like, just little things about the production, like, I'd never thought it was. Obviously, with Doctor Who, and because of British TV, right, you'll have other people write episodes, but the person in charge will rewrite every episode.
Yes.
And whether or not they put their name on it is a thing. That is actually discussed, like, how Davies chooses to do that.
Right.
And when he decides to step in, but that he almost never did any rewrites on Moffat. He just was like, no, they're fine. He doesn't need me to step in. Which is interesting.
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, and that's one of the reasons that one of the obvious reasons, for example, that, like, the Doctor Dances episodes and so on feel very un-Davies-like, because clearly he didn't. There's very little of his voice in that mix. Yeah, it's funny because I knew this sort of factoid from back in the day when I would watch Buffy on DVD, and you realize when you're watching it and you're listening to commentaries as you do, just how much of a voice, or what exactly the role that Joss Whedon played, which was essentially he would look at the scripts and he would just insert or rewrite whole scenes and just tweak throughout till it sort of matched. So it was almost like he was an editor in chief.
Right.
That's what the showrunner.
And not
is,
all
actually.
Shows work like that either. Like it does depend on the show, but
exactly.
Most British TV specifically really does.
Yes. Yeah.
And anything Sorkin does,
yes,
really works that way.
Yes,
but yeah, no, just picking apart Davies' brain. I think, and again, like I loved Davies' Doctor Who, like you do, before this, but like after it, I think it's where I really was just, and it was sad because it came out, of course, after he'd left.
Yeah,
but even so, like it has colored the way I look at his episodes, and especially how I watch certain episodes of the show, knowing. Like that first episode, where it was, there was going to be this other companion, right up until, casting.
Oh, interesting.
And, she had a name, she had a thing, and, the only people who knew about her were Davies and this journalist in these emails.
Huh.
That's the only place she existed, there's a sketch of her and all this. And then he actually wrote her into the episode as kind of a gift to, himself, but also to that journalist. She gets
nice.
Like a little bit in the episode.
Is it in the pilot or somewhere else in the season?
It's in the first episode of season 4. I can tell you who it is.
Oh, sure.
If you remember the episode well, remember that reporter?
Yeah.
Yeah, Penny. She was going to be the companion.
Oh, interesting. And this was the episode with the adipose.
Yes.
The...
And part of it was that they really wanted to get what's her face back. Like, that was their dream casting.
Right.
To be Donna, to bring back Donna's companion, but they're like, she's incredibly busy. There's no way she could do it. And someone convinced them to ask. And she was like, fuck yes. it was just... They hadn't thought to just ask. So, yeah, it is a fascinating look back.
Yeah, I think.
And it's one of my. I think it's my all time favorite book on writing, just on the writing condition, and I read it every 2 or 3 years.
Huh. I should just go and order myself a copy.
Actually, what I'm really curious about now, and I'm going to look this up while we're doing this.
Sure.
Let me see. Oh, no, wrong book. I am now weirdly curious if there has ever been an audiobook version. No. Because I was like, I just wonder if they would just be reading emails. That'd be very strange.
Do you know, I've never gotten into audiobooks.
I haven't either. I've never, I've tried. For me, at least, it hits the same way as podcasts. I just start drifting.
Yeah.
But I found a way to read podcasts, which I pace. Or I do it on the treadmill or something like that, so I can't do anything else.
Right.
And the Brooklyn Nine-Nine podcast, which is 6 episodes long, is delightful.
Oh, speaking of which.
Yeah.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I haven't watched the episode yet, but the first 2 episodes.
Oh, they're good.
Oh, good. Good, good, good.
They do a thing, because remember last season they had to reintroduce the show?
Right.
We don't have to do that again.
Oh, good.
So, it's just full on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. It was so good to just have that show back.
Uh-huh. Wow, this is...
Yeah.
This is great.
It's already shaping up to just be a really good season.
So, okay, I'm in.
But yeah, there is, if you didn't know, the they did the Good Place podcast, and in there, there's a Brooklyn Nine-Nine mini episode. They dropped all 6 episodes at once. They did a Brooklyn Nine-Nine podcast, and no one knows if there's going to be any more of it.
Huh.
But it is 6 episodes, an hour and a half each, that with various casts and all this, and Mark Evan Jackson hosting, cover a season and episode.
Oh, wow.
Mostly focusing on one episode from the season, but just covering different stuff. There's an episode on just guest cast.
Huh.
And some of the stuff, especially in the first episode, is fascinating with the, like, how the show came to be and just roads they didn't take.
Oh, that is fascinating.
And some, like, casting choices that almost happened.
Oh.
You know, like, you know, what's his name? Mizukis, who does,
Yeah, yeah, I know.
What's his face? I can't think of the character's name.
Derek in The Good Place, at least.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was almost, like, he tried out for Charles.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they were just trying to figure out, like, what that dynamic should be between the two characters, so let's try a bunch of different energies.
Gotcha.
So, that, yeah, there was a lot going on there.
Yeah, that would have been a very different show.
Yeah. Yeah. And, like, the original show that they pitched was very different, and one of the execs at the network was like, why don't you do this instead? And they were dead right. And, like, it became the show that we know. See, sometimes network notes work. Don't count on it, but sometimes network notes work.
You never know. Huh. Well, that is fascinating.
So yeah, that's well worth a listen. And as far as audiobooks go, like, because I have found a way to do it, I've tried some audiobooks since. And one that actually was working for me for a while, I kind of fell off of it, was that trilogy, The Robots. What the hell is that trilogy named?
The
Sleeping Giants and all that.
Oh, Sylvain Neuvel's...
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
The audiobooks for that, just so you know, are fully produced, like, radio cast.
Oh, nice.
So that different, you know, narrators for every voice, because
well,
it is
that style, like, the way that that's written, right, would really suit that kind of production.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, because given that it is kind of an oral history, and the actors they got are perfect.
Huh.
So, like, I do highly recommend, like, if you can just even get, like, listen to, like, I guess the sample only has, like, one person, but if you can find a bit of it, it's worth listening to, like, a few chapters just to go, like, wow, that works.
Oh, cool. I will.
I don't know that I'll keep listening to it just because I always forget audiobooks, and, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But that's good. But, good to know.
Yeah. Anyway, we are hitting the hour mark.
We are. We should probably get ourselves all tidied up for the rest of the day.
Play a little bit of music.
Woo, music.
Woo.